Scary Stories by Peter Bernard.
Is the Wisconsin Wolfman from space?
Read by Madeline Starr. I was never interested in monsters or weird stuff, but now I have a 12-year-old son, and monsters are all he can talk about. One night at dinner, he was telling me about a monster he read about that lives in Wisconsin. He asked me, didn't I used to live in Wisconsin? Of course, he knew that I had, so I asked him what the monster was. When he said it was a dog man, I dropped my fork onto my plate loudly and scared the crap out of our cat. I had nearly forgotten the story, but when he said that, it all came back in a rush, and I told him my story from back in the early 1990s. He insisted I had to pass it on to others, so for the sake of my son, here is the story of the craziest thing that ever happened to me. Okay, it was either 1991 or 1992, and I was driving home from a concert. Yes, it was grunge. I was in college, and that's what I liked. Don't ask me what bands we saw that night, but it would have been local bands. It was a show at a local bar that my friends hung out at. So I was driving home alone, and the road I was taking cut through the forested area over there. There were no streetlights, but everything seemed lit up almost like daytime. After a while, I started to wonder where all the ambient light was coming from, and then I saw it. Some huge something lit up all bright in the sky, moved out into my field of vision through my front windshield. It must have been directly above me up until that moment. Even at that time, I thought it was odd I didn't feel panicked by this. It moved out further in front, and I remember thinking, are you following me, or am I following you? And in my head, I heard the response. We all follow the same lead. It felt like someone talking to me in my brain, but it also felt like me talking to myself. And I still felt totally relaxed and fine with all of this. I saw the light move away and seemed to land somewhere in the forest off to my right. Everything got much darker after it left. There was no moon out that night, or streetlights on that stretch of highway. I wonder where my friend is gone, I thought, then realized I had said it out loud. I got wrapped up in thought, wondering why I'd referred to that light in the sky as a friend. And I'm afraid I wasn't really paying as much attention to the road as I should have been when the creature jumped out onto the road right in front of me. I was barely able to swerve out of the way in time. My car entered into a spin, and everything seemed to be occurring in extra slow motion as the car spun around to face the thing again. I could see it was very tall, very broad-chested, and stood like a man. But it was not a man. It had a dog's head. Or a wolf's head? A coyote head? I'm not sure. It was a tall, hairy man with a dog's head. His legs were bent backwards like a dog's legs. Or like the devil's. The car, still in slow motion, spun around so that I was facing away from the monster, then back again to where he was. And I could see him run off the road, still on his hind legs, and off into the forest where I could see him no longer. The car spun around, so I was once again facing the direction I wanted to go in, and somehow I miraculously hit the gas pedal at the exact right moment and sped off down the highway as though nothing at all had happened. As calm as I had felt during the sighting of the strange light, that's how terrified I was after seeing the wolf man or dog man or whatever that thing was. For the rest of the way home, I was convinced I was being watched. I never sped so fast or drove so dangerously in my life, before or since. When I got home, I ran into the house so fast that I didn't realize till the next day I had left my car door unlocked. Fortunately, nobody else realized either, and all my stuff was intact as I had left it. I had no explanation for either part of the story, and I can't tell you for certain that the first part is related in any way to the second part. All I know is I saw a strange light. Then a few minutes later, I saw a strange creature. I don't know if that thing came from the light, or if the light spooked him and made him exit the forest. To be honest, I can't be sure I didn't imagine the entire episode. I mean, what evidence can I produce that it even happened? All I know is, I moved out of Wisconsin the next month, and I've been quite happy here in New York City for all that time since then. We've got a lot of crazy things here in the Big Apple. But as far as I know, we don't have any werewolves.
Let me tell you the story of Mr. X. Back in the 1960s, I was good friends with a gentleman by the name of John J. Robinson. Jack lived over in Jersey City, and he was a massive collector of material on UFOs, the Shaver mystery, and anything unusual. We used to meet at Jack's house, every couple of weeks, a group of us would sit around. Augie Roberts, well-known photographer who had taken snapshots of UFOs over the New York City skyline. Jim Mosley, editor of the Saucer News. We'd sit around and we'd bullshit for a jackpot just up all night to the wee hours discussing these subjects. Jack was a regular guest on the all-night talk show Long John Neville. Long John was, of course, one of the pioneers, the main pioneer in late-night talk shows. Took phone calls from listeners in 30 states and had on a lot of people who claimed some pretty far-out stuff, from those like Howard Menger and George Adamski, who said that they had taken trips on board flying saucers to other planets and said it in a very sincere manner and made you want to believe it, to people like Jack, who was an investigator and a collector. Anyway, Jack related the story to me, and I published it in The Subterranean Worlds Inside Earth, and basically it's told in the words of Mr. X himself. Jack never did tell me the name of the individual, the actual name of the individual, because the fellow was not interested, as you can understand why in just a few minutes, in any sort of publicity or to get his name around. He didn't want to be pestered by investigators. He just wanted to keep to himself. So Mr. X's story starts as thus. When I was 17, I had just graduated from high school. I spent my summer vacation visiting a former schoolmate who had moved from Los Angeles. His family had moved to a small town northwest of Los Angeles. I will not tell you the state of the town, for when I finish you might try to investigate, and since I lost one friend, I have no wish to lose another. My boyhood's friend's name was Fred, and we had arranged that I would visit him for the summer whenever I graduated. I arrived at the bus station of his town, and Fred met me at the station. He took me to his home, where it was arranged that we would share the room in the attic while I visited. Fred had borrowed a bike for my use that summer, and we started to make trips to the country towards the north of town, where the country was wild and still mountainous. The town was located south of a group of mountains, which, while they were not too high, were high enough for us to enjoy climbing about. One day, Fred told me that he would have to spend the next day minding his sister's children. He said he would take a late afternoon bus and travel to his sister's home about 25 miles away. He was going to stay overnight so his sister and her husband could start early the next morning on a business trip. But he told me, "I'm only be gone for the day. You can have our room for yourself. I'll be home late the next night." Fred suggested that since he had to leave on the late bus, we visit a place even he had never gone to. A section of country only 3 hours of fast cycling from the town. It was a place the town people called the Haunted Mine. The townspeople usually avoided it, he said. I asked him why the mine was said to be haunted, and he told me that the people who had dug the mine ran into some sort of long cave like a tunnel after they had dug down quite a ways. It was after this that they had had trouble. What sort of trouble? Mr. X wanted to know. Well, he didn't exactly know, but according to what he had heard, miners had been killed when portions of this tunnel fell in on them. Other miners had disappeared, and he understood that a couple of the deaths of investors in the mine had been seemingly strange, but he didn't really have all the details. At any rate, all the troubles seemed to start after they broke into this underground space. The mine had evidently petered out. No one visited the mine or lived near it anymore. I asked Fred how we would manage to locate the mine if he had never been there. But Fred said that a friend of his had visited the mine and told him about the roads and how to locate it. When I asked Fred, my friend, if he could persuade his friend to go along, Fred said that the friend had broken his neck falling from a cliff he was climbing the day after he had visited the mine. That's odd, isn't it? I asked Fred, and he told me the only thing odd about it was that his friend had climbed the cliff when a path leading to the top was only a 10-minute walk from where he was found clutching a piece of black cloth in his hand. I guess he spotted the piece of black cloth, climbed up to get it, and fell when he reached for it. We started out for the haunted mine early that morning and cycled on until we were somewhere way up in the mountains. We had to leave our bicycles because the road we came to was so bad that it was impassable. Fallen trees and large rocks had rolled down the side of the mountain. We left our cycles and started to climb up the road. Fred told me the opening to the mine was located on that road, but that the road led around the other side of the mountain. We climbed the road for about 20 minutes, and then we rounded the mountain and came upon a spur of rock. When we continued on the road around the rock, we came to a cleared area, which had several deserted buildings standing together on the edge of the mountain. Past the buildings loomed a pile of debris, which had evidently been dug from the ground and allowed to slide past the top of the pile down the side of the mountain. The entrance to the mine was evidently located behind one of the buildings and on the other side of the pile of debris. We passed the building and started around the pile from the mine when suddenly we came to the entrance. It was then we saw him. Standing on the edge of the mine, as if on guard, was the most frightening creature I had ever seen. The being, that's what I call him, the being was about 4.5 feet tall, but very large around, with eyes large and circular, and the head seemed to be covered with a sort of hood. While it seemed to have wings which were folded around in front of it, we saw no arms. The portion of the body on what might be a person's chest was covered with large scales of almost a reptilian nature, like the skin of a huge snake. There was a projection that seemed to come up from what might be termed the shoulders and outlined the back of the lower portion of the head. The being, the creature, whatever you want to call it, had no neck. Projecting behind it like a spread cloak seemed to be a huge bird-like tail. The legs were short and chunky, and the feet, if that's what they were, seemed to be encased in a sort of box-like boot, or if it were not a boot, to be more like the type of a hoof. What appeared to be the face had eyes and a mouth, and with what might have been termed a nose, it reminded me of the look of a demon from hell. Mr. X continues, when the being saw us, it let out a scream, like an animal, and started around the edge of the mine towards us. It rustled its wings or cloak as if it had arms, but we did not stop to see. We broke out of the paralysis of fright and wheeled in retreat at full speed. We covered the 20 more minutes of hillside road in less than 5. Believe me, we got out of there in a hurry. We grabbed our bicycles and set off at breakneck speed over the road for home. We rode so fast that we covered that 3-hour journey in less than 2.5 hours. Fred drove directly to the bus station where he checked his cycle and got on the bus. I locked my bike outside the local motion picture theater and took in the show. During the latter part of the picture, I noticed a rather short person with a dark face, even in the dim theater, who seemed to be going up and down the aisle, evidently looking for someone. He seemed to stop very often at the row of seats I was in and glance down them in my direction. At the end of the picture, I left the show with a crowd of people. As I started to ride my cycle home to Fred's house, I felt as if someone or something was following me. And in some of the street intersections, I noticed people who seemed to be similar to the person dressed in black who had prowled the aisles of the theater. When I passed rapidly, these people always seemed to be watching me. But since it was dark by then, I couldn't be sure. At one time, a short person dressed in black dived out of an alley toward me on a deserted street. But I swerved around him and raced on towards Fred's house. I rode frantically down a tree-covered lane toward home, or at least where I was staying, when suddenly a huge limb of a tree broke off above me. Were it not for my speed, the limb would have crushed me beneath it. As it was, the leaves on the outermost branches whipped across my back and the rear wheel of my bicycle. I arrived at Fred's home and drove up the driveway, leaving my cycle at the foot of the porch. I dived up the stairs and rang the bell frantically. As I did so, I noticed a short figure start towards the house from a corner about 200 yards away. Fred's mother answered the door, and I told her that I was tired and was going to bed at once. When I reached the attic room, I drew the blinds and lit the lights and packed all my clothes. After that, I put out the light and cracked the blind. As I looked out, I felt sure that I could see a dark form squatting in the tree limb, which came close to the window in the nearest tree. Although the night was hot, I did not open the window, nor did I sleep at all. Instead, I kept watch all that night, and I know that there was someone in that tree, for his shadow drifted down the side of the tree and crossed the lawn shortly before daylight. In the morning, I told Fred's mother that I had called home that evening from a pay station and that my parents had asked me to return home at once. I left for Los Angeles on the first bus that morning and kept a close watch to make sure I was not being followed. After I arrived home, I waited a day and then went to a pay station and called Fred. His mother said that Fred had arrived home the day I left, but that he had gone off on his bicycle that morning. To make a long story short, Fred's cycle was later found at the beginning of the impassable road to the haunted mine. To this day, Fred has never been found, and to this day, I am afraid that whoever or whatever it was that got Fred could find me.
Scary Stories by Peter Bernard. The Hate Maker, read by Madeline Starr. My dad was in the Iraq War in the Army. I was 12 when he came back in 2011. And brought us home some odd souvenirs. A lamp that looked like a genie lamp turned out to be neither magical nor valuable when we got it appraised. My mom was kind of unhappy that he gave my little brother spent shells from various weapons. But it's not like they could harm anyone, so she let him keep them. The bong candy was, shall we say, enlightening. That went fast. But the present he brought back for me was the weirdest thing I had ever seen in my life. It was a carving of a face with the hugest freaking eyes you could ever imagine. Like space alien eyes, but not all black. It had a weird expression on his face, and I found it terrifying to be around. Dad explained that it's not a he, it's a she. He said that males of that era were usually sculpted with long beards. He also told me that the face used to be part of a statue that was left in a temple to pray to the god or goddess on behalf of the person who brought the statue. So, he reasoned that it must be good luck, and he hung it directly over the head of my bed. This freaky, scary thing that I never wanted to be near was now directly over my head as I tried to get to sleep at night. Just staring forward over me, looking oddly surprised or afraid. I tried to drop hints that maybe Daddy should put it over his bed instead, because I loved him and I wanted all the good luck to go to him. He could tell I didn't like it, and he got very hurt. He explained that it's a priceless item not even known about by anthropologists or archaeologists, and that he had violated the laws of at least two countries by smuggling it home to me. He asked if he would have done that if it were a bad thing, and I said no. I had to say no. But now I knew it should really be studied by scientists. I felt much more strongly that hanging it over my bed was a bad thing. Meanwhile, throughout this conversation, the face kept staring at me with its insane and frightened-looking eyes. That night, I dreamed that I was in the desert and there was nothing but sand in any direction I looked. Then I saw a woman dancing. She was whirling in place and waving her arms up and down at her side. I began walking toward her. The closer I got, the more detail I could make out. She was surrounded by men, holding what I first took to be rifles, then realized were swords. I walked directly up to one of the men and tried to speak to him, but no sound came out of my throat. I looked at him so I could try to signal him with my hands, but I could see he had no face. I turned to look at the dancing woman, but she wasn't a woman at all. She, or it, was actually a number of writhing snakes, all intertwined. Together they formed the shape of a dancing woman by squirming and swirling around over and over. Each snake had huge eyes, like the face over my bed. One lashed out to bite me, and I woke up suddenly, shaking my bed violently in the process. The face fell off the wall, hitting me hard on the back of the head. That continued to hurt for around another week. Dad's response? He just promised he'd reinstall the face more securely, making it impossible to knock down no matter how hard the wall got shaken. Gee, thanks for missing the point, Dad. No matter how hard I begged, Daddy would not humor me about my dream. He called me his little drama princess and told me to be good. Then Mom drove me to school. She feigned interest when I told her the story again, but I could tell that nobody was going to be able to appreciate how shaken up I'd become over my strange dream. I felt really not listened to, which led me to find other things to do after school besides going home. I began sleeping over at my friends' places as much as their parents could stand, but I still had to sleep with the face 4 nights out of 7 most of the time. Every time I saw it, I was reminded that nobody cared about my feelings, and that I really didn't matter to the people I had loved the most of my life. I started listening to different kinds of music that allowed me to get out my anger and sadness by singing along to. I made new friends, and we all began to experiment with more adult ways to entertain ourselves. Probably a few years before we should have been attracted to that sort of thing. My parents began to notice these changes, and I was soon disabused of the notion that they didn't care what I did. They most certainly did care, and they hated every part of who they saw me becoming. So now, I went from feeling that I didn't matter to the people I loved, to understanding that the people I loved hated everything about me. After one particularly cruel moment from my mom in my room one night, my old piggy bank just flew off of my dresser and crashed into the wall, missing my mom's head by about a foot, and completely freaking all of us out. Pennies, dimes, and nickels were everywhere, and my mom had bits of clay and dust all over her face and in her hair. The good part about that weird occurrence is that for a day or two, the conversation about me stopped and was replaced by my parents being convinced we had a poltergeist. That soon ended when they happened upon the theory that young girls turning into women cause poltergeist occurrences by themselves. That threw them into paranoia about me, and they accused me of being into witchcraft or devil worship, or whatever they could think of. They didn't know anything about any of that stuff, except what they'd see in the movies and on Netflix, which only made them more frightened. Frightened people are no fun to be around, and frightened people convinced that you're out to hurt them are the worst people to be around. That is what the two people I loved most in the world had become, and they blamed me for it. I remember one night after my dad asked me if I was on drugs, his stupid picture of some old sports jerk flew off the wall and smashed. A piece of glass went into my brother's eye, and my dad had to drive him to the hospital. He was fine, but he almost lost eyesight in one eye. Yet, even that wouldn't wake my parents up from their spell of fear and nastiness. One night, after being screamed at and humiliated, I lay on my bed crying, and my little brother came in. "It's because of that ugly face, you know." I stopped crying long enough to look at him quizzically. "All of this," he said, motioning to the big, ugly-eyed, frightening-looking thing on my wall. "If we get rid of that, we can have our parents back." After he said that, a flood of emotion escaped from me. It was the first time someone was telling me that everything wasn't my fault since Dad had come home. Even though he had a patch over one eye, while his eye healed, my brother had a clearer vision at that moment than anyone else in the family. We had to wait till Saturday when both our parents were preoccupied, but he and I managed to Google museums and find one that would accept donations of artifacts. We packaged up both the Face of Doom and the used weaponry Dad had given my brother and mailed it off to the scientists. When my parents found out, they took it in stride and asked us to tell them first before we did something like that again. Dad told us he was proud that we thought more of helping advance scientific study than we thought of being in possession of valuable artifacts. This was my old dad, finally back from the war. All of the problems were somehow being caused by the things Dad brought back. These days, I'm in high school and I'm starting to look around at colleges. Dad and Mom have been a lot less lame about everything, and I have gone back to trusting both of them with my innermost thoughts and feelings. Some of my closest friends are having a terrible time with their families, and I wish all of their problems could be as easy to fix as our family's problem was. Maybe in a sense, they can be. Whatever problem a family can have other than health is really a problem of them reacting to a crisis with fear instead of love. As corny as that is, it's true. It's fun to be scared with a scary story, but if you're living your life like you're in a creepypasta, then you can't expect any sort of happy ending. And that is the happy ending to my story.